Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, hosting the annual Grub Crawl on Tuesday, June 11th, starting at 5 in the Eastwood Town Center. Details and wristbands available at lansingchamber.org.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Matt Helms of the Detroit Free Press writes today that the city's emergency manager, Kevin Orr, will offer creditors of the city pennies on the dollar when they meet next week, apparently at a location near Metro Airport. That can't be too big of a surprise given the depth and the breadth of the red ink in Detroit, but it again brings to mind the profound challenges involved in avoiding bankruptcy, avoiding Chapter 9. And you got to wonder how many media microphones will be crowded around these creditors after this meeting next week. It will be a feeding frenzy. Helms writes there will be dozens of creditors, bondholders, union retirees, and on at the meeting. That's bound to be one of the big stories here next week. We hope you can stay close. We got an interesting show here for you today with some live music on current state. At the top, the number of Michigan school districts facing serious financial challenges continues to grow. Yesterday, State School Superintendent Mike Flanagan reported there are 55 districts across the state operating in the red. That's up by 6 just since the start of the year. Flanagan updates the state legislature quarterly on school finances. He commented that the situation requires, quote, more resources, unquote. Joining us to comment on the school funding challenge and other educational issues, former Michigan school superintendent and China expert Tom Watkins. Welcome back, Tom.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Mark. Thank you.
What's happening here? What's to account for this ongoing climb in the number of school districts with deficits?
Well, I think the first thing is that it's only a crisis because we've had leaders that have failed to act. This issue has been in the forefront for nearly a decade, whether it's the Citizens Research Council, the Sergeant Friday of Public Policy that laid out these issues, Michigan business leaders that have pointed it out, and even my time as state superintendent. I wrote a report called The Structural Funding Issues Facing Michigan Schools in the 21st century. And so I think what you're seeing today is kind of a Rip Van Winkle approach. I mean, people that have denied an issue was an issue, haven't taken action, and it's coming home to roost. And the action is that, as State Superintendent Flanagan has pointed out, we have, with chartered schools and our local school districts, we have over 800 school districts in the state of Michigan. A lot of those districts are losing students, and every student that walks away from a district takes approximately $10,000 with them. So if you lose 100 students, you've lost $1 million, and they haven't taken the subsequent action to downsize, to cut costs as quickly as they're losing revenue. Hence, today, as the superintendent pointed out yesterday, 55 school districts are on the brink of financial insolvency. This is an issue that's going to require action at the state level. And as I laid out in this report nearly a decade ago, it's going to require consolidating school districts, dissolving some school districts. We have school districts as small as 400 students. And it's going to require dealing with some of the structural funding issues, particularly as it relates to the cost of health care and pensions. Until, unless we deal with these issues, we're going to continue to see this, quote, crisis facing Michigan schools.
Superintendent Flanagan made a call yesterday for county-wide school districts. Is that the kind of, are you advising consolidation similar to that?
Well, I don't think we should go to a kind of a Henry Ford, where he said, you can have any color car you want as long as it's black. I think that we ought to take a look at how schools are organized and come up with a more efficient and effective way. That may be countywide school district. That's the way they do it in Maryland and in Florida as an example. But I think that if we put thoughtful minds together, and in fact, I have an article on this very subject in today's Dome magazine. Your listeners can see it at domemagazine.com, where I say that we really need to put people from the left and the right in a room and to come up with a shared vision and common agenda at how we address the needs of public education. We spend over $13 billion a year for 550 school districts, 55 intermediate school districts, 300 chartered schools. And we need to ask ourselves, if we found this place called Michigan with 1.6 million students to educate and $13 billion dollars that washed up on our shore each year, would anybody in their right mind create the system that we currently have now to prepare our kids for a hyper-competitive, disruptive knowledge economy where ideas and jobs can and do move around the world instantaneously? I don't think they would.
At the same time, Superintendent Flanagan says 23 districts indicate they are projected to reduce deficits this year. Are these presumably then the districts to which students are going that are actually seeing some kind of net increase in their enrollment?
Well, I think, again, each community is different because you do have students moving into some districts and leaving others. But a number of these districts have been perpetual in financial distress. There's only three ways to balance a budget, and that is to either increase your revenue, which local districts do not have the ability to do under state law, it's state-funded school districts, decrease your expenditures, which oftentimes are very difficult to do at the rate that some districts are losing students, or a combination of increasing revenue and decreasing expenditures. What we have is what I would say is a kind of pretend and spend approach. We pretend as though we're going to see a student enrollment increase when, in fact, districts continue to lose students, and that puts them in financial distress. Sooner or later, if you got a hole in your roof, pretending to fix it doesn't keep the rain out. You absolutely have to get up there and fix the hole, and a lot of these districts have been pretending and spending for far too long.
Is the Saginaw Buena Vista situation, the shutdown up there, is that a logical manifestation of this problem that you're talking about?
Well, I think that it's compounded by it appears where they accepted money, $400,000+ for a program they were no longer existing. So it appears that there's either lack of oversight, mismanagement, a little dishonesty, coupled with not dealing with reality. But again, I mean, here's a community that's in an urban area, 450 students. We have elementary schools that are larger than that. We need to take a look and ask ourselves, is this the best way to use limited tax dollars to prepare our children for their future and not our past? We need to ask fundamental questions. Are schools run for TLC? And I don't mean tender loving care, but are they run for teaching, learning, and children? Or is it more about power, control, politics, and adults? And the focus is on TLC, teaching, learning, and children. Adults make solid decisions that benefit our kids. And when it's not, we end up with the kind of mess that we're seeing today.
We're talking with former Michigan School Superintendent Tom Watkins about education in Michigan. The new state budget includes an increase of a few percent in school funding. What's the relevance of that?
Well, Mark, this is the fundamental question, is we have a structural imbalance of school funding. In fact, I call it the pothole of educational funding. School districts, based upon the legacy cost, primarily around salaries, health care, and pensions. And while there's been some action on the pension side of this equation, school districts need between $250 to $300 new money just to deal with those three issues. If they don't get it, the superintendents and the school boards have to act like the old Pac-Man game, finding ways to gobble up and cut other costs. And if you imagine a pothole, the first $100 of new money that comes into a school district pays for pension costs, and these are approximations. The next shovelful of asphalt that comes into school funding covers health care for retirees. The third shovel of new money that comes in takes care of health care for existing staff. Now, when you figure that schools have not seen anything more than about a $75 on average increase for nearly the last decade, you see the problem that we are in. And so if we're not going to find a way to either put these resources in and make the school districts whole, we're going to continue to see these kind of cuts that are going to happen. This new money that comes in sounds like a large sum of money, but it's a number of districts are going to get, after they get a minimal payment for their pension, about $5 extra per child.
Yeah.
And with the fixed cost, you could see the problem.
Yesterday, the State House passed a measure that loosens up the state-mandated merit curriculum. A couple of supporters of this move were on our program on Wednesday, claiming that the change would help them overcome a shortage of workers in construction. How compelling a case is there for loosening up existing mandatory curriculum in Michigan?
Look, our children are not competing against just the kid in the next desk over or even the next school district over. Our children are going to need to be able to collaborate and compete with the children of the world. And I think having high, rigorous academic standards is the direction that we should go, and provide the local districts the flexibility, which I believe that they have, in order to accommodate both high quality academic performance of the university and vocational training programs. I think this is kind of a tempest in the teapot. There are ways to do it within the existing structure.
It's a very interesting landscape, really, because you've got compelling calls for both toughening some standards and loosening up other standards. Where is this headed?
Well, and I believe that the state is heading in the right direction in this way, and that is the state should set very high, rigorous academic standards and then say to the local districts, it's in essence saying, we expect you to be at California at the end of the year. How you get there is up to the local districts. So there are ways that they have the flexibility, in my estimation, in order to have both their cake and eat it too, have the high standards and allow the local districts to find different ways to reach those standards.
Tom Watkins is Michigan's former state school superintendent. Tom Watkins, always a pleasure. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
That's live music coming to you from Current State here this morning in East Lansing. Eldon Kelly is a performer this weekend, tomorrow, at East Lansing's Pump Stock Music Festival. And Eldon and a couple of organizers from Pump Stock join us here in just a little bit, and we'll be hearing more from Eldon here throughout the show. Onward with Current State. In the coming decades, if NASA has its way, the long, harrowing trip to Mars will be more than just a Hollywood movie directed by the likes of Michael Bay. The space agency has said it plans to send astronauts to the Red Planet by the early 2030s. Now, while 20 years is a long way off, NASA has already begun the planning and research, and MSU scientists are part of these early stages. One of them is Deborah Feltz, a university distinguished professor of kinesiology. Her team recently received a $1.2 million grant to develop a fitness program for the mission, so that when the first astronauts arrive on Mars after the long trip from Earth, they still have the strength to take that one small step for man. Deborah Feltz joins us now on Current State. Welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Mark.
Tell us about the work that you'll be doing here exactly.
Well, the fitness program has actually been developed already from exercise physiologists down at the Johnson Space Center.
Okay.
And it's a pretty rigorous program, 6 days a week, so they get 1 day off. But following that program over months and months and months and months is difficult, boring, and they may start to slack off. In fact, they know that that does happen sometimes as time goes by. So our grant is to try to keep that motivation up so that they'll continue in this program and work at the intensity and the level of effort that they need to in order to mitigate the bone loss and muscle loss and cardiovascular function that can occur in an anti-gravity or microgravity state.
This is after they're on the planet? I'm saying these words. This is after they're on Mars?
This is to get them there.
Oh okay. This is leading up to that.
This is while they're traveling.
Okay.
They have a fitness program. This is to help keep them motivated to follow that program.
Oh boy, you have answered a huge question. If you can get any progress on this, how do you get people to keep working out? Right.
Right.
There's probably relevance for that for people all over the place.
There certainly is.
What happens to astronauts in space physically? You alluded to bone loss, and obviously it's a zero gravity or close to zero gravity environment. How does that impact fitness and health?
Right. Well, I'm not an exercise physiologist. I do have an exercise physiologist on the grant, Jim Pavarnik, who's also in our department. But what I do know is that they lose bone density. And they lose muscle function. They lose bone density. If they're not following an exercise program, they can lose as much bone density in 1 month as a postmenopausal woman can lose in a year.
Oh.
So it's substantial. It's really substantial. And that's because they don't have gravity to work against, like we do on Earth, to build that, to keep that density up and their muscle function up. They don't need to have it.
Is a lot of weight-bearing exercise a part of the regimen that's been put together? Because I'm led to believe that's great to avoid or prevent calcium bone density.
Absolutely. So the program that's put together, we'll only be following the aerobic program with a cycle ergometer, so that a stationary bike.
Mm-hmm.
And so that will get at some of the muscle in terms of some resistance there as well. But in the full program, they have weight training. So they have an apparatus that they work on with a weight load. They have a stationary bike, and they have a treadmill, and that's all a part of their exercise regimen. We'll focus, for this particular grant, we'll focus specifically on the stationary bike, and they'll be doing a combination of some days continuous 30-minute cycling at about 75% of their heart rate max. Other days they'll be doing sprints, 30-second sprints, eight of those with some rest in between. And some other days they'll be doing something that's a little bit in between. It'll be interval training, but it won't necessarily be all out sprinting.
But
so that combination.
It sounds like there's a psychological dimension to the work you're doing, though. You're trying to maintain this desire, this inclination to stay with it.
Right. That's our part, and that's what the grant is all about. And what we're doing there is actually working with another colleague, Brian Wynn, from the telecommunications, to develop a virtual partner. This is a virtual exercise partner.
Mm. An avatar?
Like an avatar, that's right. And that avatar will be slightly better than the participant on the bike. Eventually, the the astronaut, but not insurmountable. And
slightly better. What do you mean slightly better?
Well, we don't have the exact a number of seconds or speed that the virtual partner would be better, but it might be, you know, maybe a wheel's length ahead of the participant, so slightly pedaling faster.
So you're hoping that this virtual person that they'll be with will be some kind of competitive. There'll be some kind of competitive dynamic to incentivize the actual astronaut.
We'll actually compare a competitive condition with another condition that's more collaborative, where a team score is based on the so-called weak link, the weaker of the two, which is always going to be the astronaut.
How about that? Memories of the HAL 2000 computer are going through my head from 2001. Somebody cue up Daisy in there. More generally, what do you know about how you get people motivated to exercise? Well, how much do we know now?
Well, there's a lot that we don't know and less that we do. But from the work that I have been doing, what we do know is that if you're working with somebody, that's more motivating than when you're out there by yourself.
Okay, hence the avatar.
Hence the avatar. And if that person is slightly better than you, you work harder than if the person is slightly behind you. So you think of running running around a track, and if you have that person who's just you know, a step or two ahead of you, and you're trying to keep up, you work harder than if you're ahead of them or if you're just running by yourself.
What's been the focus of your work up until this came along? Have you worked on this fitness in space idea before or other areas?
Not in space at all before. It's been in other areas, and we had a previous grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation where we were starting in this area. And for that grant, we had virtually presented partners who you thought were real. So you didn't know that they weren't. We manipulated that.
Hmm.
And we found these kinds of results that when you worked with someone, especially if you worked with someone in a what we call a conjunctive way, it's a collaborative way, and your score was based on the weaker of the two, that it was very motivating, much more motivating, especially at effort-based tasks than when you were working by yourself or even when you were working in a competitive situation.
How about that? What's it like to know that you could be working on the first trip to Mars?
It's amazing.
It's got to be.
It's just really exciting. I never, ever would have thought that I would be doing this kind of work.
Really interesting. We'll try to stay in touch with you on this. Deborah Feltz is a university distinguished professor of kinesiology at MSU, and she recently received a grant from NASA to develop a fitness training program for the first astronauts who will embark on a mission to Mars. Thanks for joining us today, Deborah.
Thank you.
Musician Eldon Kelly, who's one of a handful of performers tomorrow at the 4th Annual Pumpstock Music Festival at East Lansing's Bailey Park. And we will be talking with Eldon and organizer Smitty Smith coming up in just a little bit here on Current State. We look forward to that an awful lot. Well, as I mentioned earlier here, we remember the Flint Michigan tornado here this morning. On the 8th of June, 1953, an F5 tornado hit Flint and the nearby community of Beecher. 116 people were killed, making it the 10th deadliest tornado in U.S. history. And a generation of Michigan residents would never look at a dark sky the same way again. Jerry Hodak was the face of TV weather in the Detroit market for 45 years. He retired in 2010, but he joins us now to talk about the 60th anniversary of the Flint Beecher tornado. Jerry Hodak, a pleasure. Welcome.
Nice to be with you, Mark.
First of all, where were you on June 8th, 1953? How vividly do you remember that day?
Well, I don't remember it vividly, but I remember the pictures in the newspaper the day after. I was 11 years old, living in Detroit, and we didn't have the mass communications that we have now, so you didn't hear about things.
You didn't learn about it on Twitter,
And I didn't have my smartphone with me at the time or my iPad or any of those other little gadgets that we have nowadays that alert us right away when something's happening. So I didn't know about it really until the next day, or maybe that later that evening I might have heard a radio newscast. Television news was certainly in its infancy at that time, so you really didn't get much in the way of any video until the next day of something like that. And this happened in the evening. I think it was around 8:30 at night.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
It was late in the day, and I probably would have been in bed by the time the 11 o'clock news came on.
Some of the accounts from the survivors are pretty incredible, downright eerie. They talked about things that we've come to associate with tornadoes, the train-like sound that they heard. One person described the sound of a house coming off its foundation like a giant pencil sharpener. People found the straws embedded in the tree trunks that we've all seen the photos of, or telephone poles. Have you ever witnessed firsthand the damage done by a major tornado in your career?
Not major tornadoes. I've seen a number of smaller ones. There was one here in Corona in about 1967, I think it was. And it came through Owosso and Corona. And mainly it was outbuildings on farms. But you could get an idea of what the force of a tornado could do. And, of course, I've seen plenty of video since and pictures and that sort of thing. But no, I've never been immediately afterward in an area that has had a major tornado.
It's kind of a warped thing to wish for, but I find myself kind of wishing I could witness a tornado. I think that there's a little bit of latent storm chaser in a lot of people, I think.
Well, you know, we call tornadoes, or we give them the designation of F4 or F5, and that was an F5 tornado. And the F stands for Fujita, and that
right.
was Dr. Theodore Fujita at University of Chicago. And back in the mid-70s, I went to Chicago to his lab and interviewed him, and I asked him that very thing. He had pictures of cumulus clouds all around his office and in the hallway and everything. And I said, well, have you ever seen a tornado? And he said, no. He'd been hopping a plane, has a plane ready when tornadoes are breaking out in the Midwest. But he had never been fortunate enough, at least at that point, to see one. And yet he had been studying them his whole life.
What do you make of this storm chaser phenomenon? I mean, it's all over the Weather Channel. It's all over cable TV.
Well, with the events this week down in Oklahoma, obviously it's a hot topic of conversation
yes.
now. And that three fellows who were professional tornado chasers or storm chasers were killed. And, you know, you've got a lot of tours now that they're booking or you pay and they'll take you out and you can
People come from
chase
Europe.
Them.
People
right.
come from England and all over the place to the United States to try to see a tornado.
We did that one year back in the late 90s down in Oklahoma and Texas, and I began to see then how popular it was becoming. It was right after that movie Twister came out.
Yeah.
And then it became very popular, and the roads are literally clogged with people who are just out wanting to see a tornado.
Amazing.
And sometimes you don't have enough room to turn around and run the other way.
Flint happened at about the time that severe storm forecasting was changing. A severe weather unit within what was called then the Weather Bureau was formed in 1952. The first weather bulletin to resemble a tornado watch was also issued that year. Then the unit ramped up even more after Flint.
Absolutely.
In some other tornadoes in 1953. How have you seen tornado forecasting change over the course of your career?
Big question. Well, I'll give you an example, too. 53 was really a bad year. In fact, few people remember, but just 2 weeks before the Flint tornado, there was one in Port Huron and went over into Sarnia. My wife was an 11-year-old at that time, living in Port Huron, and there was little warning for that. Her sister was working at the hospital, and they got word that there was a tornado, I suspect from the police department, and she called home and said, get to the basement. And my wife and her brother went down the basement, and sure enough, there, where they were on their glassed-in porch was obliterated by the tornado. So, yeah, it was a very busy year, and we saw things ramp up after that. I started forecasting in Detroit in 65, and that was right after the Palm Sunday, April 11th tornadoes. And it was right after that they started using the terms watch and warning, too. Up to that, it was just an alert. And I think that was some ambiguous enough that people didn't really know what does that mean. Along came Doppler radar in the 1980s. We've gone from having very little warning to now getting several hours of alerts before a tornado touches down. And now with Doppler radar, you're able to pinpoint exactly the clouds where it's occurring and how fast it's moving, in what direction, and who should take cover.
It's a little confusing because one of the more recent developments that I've noticed is you hear from the Weather Service of severe thunderstorms capable of producing a tornado. So they seem to be finalizing or narrowing down the circumstances an awful lot.
Indeed, and I think that's it. You can't. We're not to the point yet where we can say a tornado will definitely hit this specific spot. I think the day is coming, however.
You wonder where we're going to be in 20
years. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, with drones up now, they're going to use drones to fly them through the tornado clouds and hopefully gather enough information that we can learn how these things form.
What goes through your head when you are the guy that everybody is watching and counting on for the latest information? How stressful has that been in your career?
Well, it's a very stressful day because you realize that lives are on the line, and it's the immediacy of it. How fast can we get this on the air and explain it and get the word to those people who are vulnerable to this storm to take cover? A lot of people will hear the terms, and they're fascinated by tornadoes, so they go to a window to look and see if they can see it when they ought to be going into the basement or a small room and getting away from windows. So it's getting it on the air as quickly as you can with absolutely the best information that you have as to where the storm is and where it's going.
Your career spanned those years when I think an awful lot more of TV stations' budgets got funneled into weather. What is the fascination? How has weather become such a big topic?
Well, I think it's the science of it all, and we're able to boil it down and just digest it into language that people at home can understand. I think young kids are fascinated by the science of it all, by the Doppler radar, by showing the storms moving and the graphics as to where they will move in the next hour or so. And we can now analyze the clouds. We can look at them in a vertical situation and show you why hail may form. And it's a fascinating topic. And I think with computer graphics now and the ability to actually analyze a storm while it's in progress is just a fascinating process.
Are you? Did you ever find yourself itching to be back on the air doing the weather in Detroit?
I wouldn't be honest if I said no, I don't wish to do that. There are days, though, I just like to sit in my easy chair and look out the window and watch the storm clouds roll by and not have the stress of having to be on the air to do it.
How much do you feel you learned about the science of weather during your career? I mean, obviously the science evolved an awful lot over
exactly.
All those years.
And I think that's part of it, too. Your previous guest was talking about her study now into the astronauts going to Mars. And she told me earlier when we were sitting getting ready to go on the air that she started out to be a gym teacher. So look at how far she's come from where she started out. And I think the same with me. You just keep your mind open. And the technology, though, is moving so rapidly that the piece of equipment that you buy today is probably out of date by next month, and there's a new piece of equipment you need in order to tell the story.
Well, my most frequently used app on my cell phone is My Radar. I mean, I can't let more than a few hours go by without checking the precipitation of the radar and the cloud cover. And all
exactly,
that.
I'm the same because many people ask me, "Is it going to rain? It's starting to cloud up." Well, with a smartphone, you can check right away.
Was there ever another career that you were looking at closely, or was this really all everything you ever wanted to do?
I started out to be a radio newsman, and sort of got sidetracked along the way because I had a few weather courses in college because I was interested in it just as a hobby. And when I got into television, I was one of the few people around that had had any academic brush with meteorology, so they asked me one day to do the weather, and I did it the next day and the next day, and 45 years later, I was still doing it. So it just happens sometimes.
It's amazing that Sonny Elliott enjoyed the long career that he did, and there was still room for you to make such a huge impression on the Detroit market.
I thought anybody was insane to go up against Sonny Elliott. And I said so many times, and when they told me they wanted me to do that, I thought, well, this may not last very long, and it could get ugly. So, but Sonny was a good, great competitor, and I he had his own way of telling the weather story, and I just figured my background is more of in the scientific end of it. So I'll do that. If it works, great. If it doesn't, I'll move on to something else.
Since you were an aspiring news person for so long, I'm sure you pay attention to the news as well. What do you feel is the role of television news in local markets like Lansing and in even larger markets like Detroit?
Well, it's evolving, and I think no one really knows what they should be doing or what they can do to make it continue to evolve because there's so much competition for the viewer now, either by iPads or iPhones they get their news, or other media. So and then the advertising dollar is of course not what it once was, because there is such a fractious audience now.
Exactly.
That it's there isn't the same amount of revenue in it that there once was. Not to say that it's bad by any means, but I think many news directors and markets are struggling with what direction should television news take now. We want to be your friend. We're here for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not doing the news of the day so much anymore as news that affects our audience. Who's our audience, and how can we tell the stories that they're interested in? And it's finding that out and being alert to it that, the social media has been helpful in that regard. Every station now has its own website, and they send you there to get more information. And also let us know on Facebook, friend us on Facebook, and tell us what you think.
All these platforms.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
So many
different directions, so many options. Jerry Hodak was the face of TV weather in Detroit for 45 years. He retired in 2010, but he's graciously joined us this morning to remember the 1953 Flint tornado. Jerry, thank you.
My pleasure.
Music coming to you live from Studio S here at WKAR in East Lansing. Eldon Kelly is the player, and we're going to talk with Eldon about this weekend's fourth annual Pump Stock Music Festival that happens tomorrow in East Lansing's Bailey Park. and it features live American roots music and local food. Here with us now is the festival's coordinator, Dudley Smith, more commonly known as Smitty Smith, and Eldon Kelly also stands by to join us here in just a few minutes. Hi, Smitty. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. For our listeners who don't know that much about Pump Stock, tell us about it. How did it get started? It's fourth time around.
Yeah, the story of Pump Stock starts with the story of Pump House Concerts. My wife and I, after living in Nashville for a few years back, were kind of disappointed at the availability of local venues for this kind of music that are listening room style, where when the music starts, the people shut up and listen. Okay, as opposed to a bar where the TV's on and people are watching a football game. So we started doing concerts in the Pump House, which is in the middle of the Bailey neighborhood. And after about a year of that, we thought, you know, this is fun. We host a show every month. It's all donation-based. The musicians stay with us often. We thought, wouldn't it be fun to do something outdoors, maybe all day long?
Hmm.
So Pump House Concerts, we kind of borrowed the Woodstock idea, and we come up with Pump Stock. And we've been doing it since, this is the fourth year, like you said. And so we thought, you know, inside the Pump House, it's hard to have a full band with drums and things like that. The seating's about 60 people at the most. So this is more fun because we can have full bands, we can have four or five acts going, we can have food, and we can have lots of people
it's
also.
It's a festival.
It's
outdoor music festival,
yeah,
right?
It's a great neighborhood-based thing. It's all volunteer-based. It's all donation-based. All the money after a very minor amount of expenses goes to the musicians, but we borrow the city's stage. The PA is donated. You know, I don't get paid anything. Nobody makes any money except sometimes I have to pay the sound guy a little bit, but it's worth paying a sound guy a little bit. But after that, all the money we bring in goes to the musicians.
Well, if Eldon's playing is any indication, there's some people with some real chops who play at this.
We've had artists that have won Grammys. We've had artists that have been nominated for Grammys. John Brooks, who's coming to the Pump House in the fall, 3 out of the last 5 years was nominated for Canadian Artist of the Year. Mike Mangione and the Union that are coming in from Chicago to headline Pump Stock this year are very successful.
Mike Mangione?
Mike Mangione.
Related to Chuck Mangione?
Nah, not that I know of.
Okay. Had to ask.
But they're a great five-piece band with some strings, a cello, and a fiddle, and just a great time. We've got Eldon.
Let's bring Eldon Kelly into the conversation here. Eldon, you're a Vermont native. How'd you wind up here in Lansing?
I got my master's at MSU in musicology.
Okay. And you're from where in Vermont?
Richmond, just near Burlington.
And what inspired you to play? Tell us what you've been playing here this morning, because we've heard some really curious sounds here.
I started off with an acoustic.
I mean that as a compliment.
Well, thank you, by the way. Yeah, curiosity is good. Nylon string, an electric nylon string guitar. Then a djembush, which is a 11-string Turkish banjo. I'm sorry, a 12-string Turkish banjo. The 11-string is the glissantar. The fretless guitar. The fretless thing allows me to slide between the notes.
Wow.
So it's kind of like a dobro, you know, or a slide guitar, but it's a little more like a sitar.
Now, how many performers are there that perform instruments like this at Pump Stock? Do they tend to be this unconventional, or do they? I imagine a few are...
No, Eldon will probably be the most varied musician that we've got.
I'm not surprised to hear that.
which is good. That's part of one of the reasons we've got him. Fantastic player and performer. Our musicians tend to be more along the lines of singer-songwriter. You know, if Lyle Lovett had his smaller band with him, perhaps, or the Indigo Girls, or sort of alt-country, folk-rock kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, Eldon Kelly, you're all strapped up here, and I think it'd be great to hear a song here. What are you going to play for us?
This is an example of my singer-songwriter side.
There you go. Okay.
And this has sort of some roots influences, American roots mixed with some bluegrass and Indian music.
Okay. Eldon Kelly.
Down by the willow way, down by the willow way, down by the willow way, down by the willow way. You'll have to lay your burden down here. You'll have to lay your burden down. You'll have to lay your burden. Thank you. shore, you take it and never look back. So boat on the shore, you take it and never look back. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Down by the willow waves, down by the willow waves, down by the willow waves, down by the willow waves. The sky will open for you, the clouds will open wide, the horizon parts before you, so you can climb inside. The sky will open for you, the clouds will open wide, the horizon parts before you, so you can climb inside. Down by the willow wait, 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 down by the willow, down by the willow wait.
Eldon Kelly, one of the performers at tomorrow's Pump Stock Festival in downtown East Lansing. Smitty Smith, remind our listeners of when the music starts and how long it goes.
Music is from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Bailey Park in East Lansing. If you need a map help, it's 300 Bailey Street. We'll have food. We'll have face painters. It's a family fun kind of event. There's a playground in the park, so if the kids get bored, they can go swing and climb.
Is the attendance growing year by year?
It is. We were, 150, 200 the first year. We're expecting more like 300 or more this year.
Okay, very good.
A little bit more each year.
You're looking for more hands? You're looking for more help? Volunteers?
Always looking for volunteers. It's totally a volunteer-based thing. There's a Facebook page for Pump Stock. There's a Facebook page for Pump House Concerts. And we have email at pumphouseconcerts@gmail.com. All one word, plural, pumphouseconcerts@gmail.com.
Very good. Smitty Smith is the organizer of and the founder and the director of Pump Stock, the American Roots Music Festival this weekend here in East Lansing. Local musician Eldon Kelly will be performing at the festival. Thanks to both of you. And Eldon's going to take us out with a little live music here on Current State. Musician Eldon Kelly here on Current State. Coming up next week in the program, we'll look at Michigan's export economy. We'll also check out the new exhibit at the Broad Art Museum and visit with Lansing Lugnuts owner Tom Dixon. That and more next week on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer of Current State. Thanks as well to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Yencio Wang for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on your phone, your tablet, and online at lsj.com.